This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so thrilled and honored that my guest today, well, he is amazing. Steve Barry, thank you for joining me here on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you for having me back.
Wow, it is just wonderful. I love your books. And the new book, The Last Kingdom, is terrific.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it so much. Cotton's back. He took a year off, but he's back in with a new adventure.
Well, we needed it. And this is book 17 in this wonderful, wonderful series. And of all your books, and I love them all. I love anything to do with history. And there is no writer who writes history as well as you do. You know, lots of thriller writers and cozy mystery writers will use history as a backdrop, but you actually know history, you study it, you go really deep. Your books are so accurate, I think really you only make up a little bit, and what you discover with your research just is always so fascinating. And in this story, which is set in Bavaria, and talks about the Wittelsbach family, which is something that's very close to my heart because I am working on a book about the Empress Sissi, the wife of Franz Joseph. So
yes.
I have been to Bavaria many times. I've been to her home in Possenhofen where she was born, which is now turned into it's a very fancy apartment complex now, but I've been there. I've walked, in her footsteps, and I've been, of course, to these castles that you talk about. So, and most of my listeners don't know that they've actually seen the castle that you talk about in the book about the Wittelsbach. They don't know anything about Ludwig II. So, tell us about it. Isn't it an exciting story?
It is, and it deals with two of my favorite things. One, Bavaria. I love it, too. I've been there many, many times. And it also deals with King Ludwig II, who is one of my favorite historical characters. He was connected to Elizabeth Sissi. They almost married, but did not. But they remained close friends, for the rest of his life. I've wanted to put Cotton into a story with Bavaria and King Ludwig, but I haven't been able to really assemble it and put it together. But I finally came up with the right thing. I was able to incorporate the three castles that Ludwig created, Herrenchiemsee, Linderhof, and Neuschwanstein. And you're correct, Neuschwanstein is one that people will recognize because that's what Walt Disney saw in the 1930s, and he used it as the model for Sleeping Beauty's castle in Disneyland. And so these three castles figure very much into the story. There's a historical fact I came across, which was true. Ludwig was, people call him Mad King Ludwig. I don't really like that term. I don't think he was mad. I think he was troubled. I think he had some mental deficiencies. Today we would probably have called him chronically depressed or bipolar. We could have treated him with therapy and drugs. He might have been able to survive in good shape, but in the 19th century that wasn't possible. So he fell into this deep, deep delusional world. And in that world, he was extremely imaginative. He created a whole lot, but he also had a lot of problems for himself. He sent a man around the world to find himself a new kingdom. He actually did do this. He wanted to find a kingdom where he could go and rule like a mythical ruler of old, not constrained by any laws or anything. And the man did do that, and he wrote a journal about it, which I was able to see. And in the real life, they never found that last kingdom, but in my book they do. And now Germany, China, and the United States are all after it, but for entirely different reasons. And that's where the chase comes on.
And the reasons are very relevant to today's world. So that's what makes it so exciting. You came out with this, you discovered something, and you, as I have just been fascinated by this family that most people don't, you know, they have not heard that name, but it's a fascinating family, and Sissy did love him very much. I mean, she was very fond of him, and what happened to him, of course, is a tragedy. But as you said, you know, being probably as you bipolar and having delusions, but in some ways we owe him a lot because with his delusions he built these wonderful castles.
Yes, that's right. He was a very forward-thinking guy. He had a great imagination, but he was also a guy that clung to the past, too, and could not let go of the past. And there's no question he had some problems and he had some issues, but he was an enigmatic figure. If I ever get a chance to write a pure historical novel set totally in the past with historical aspects, I would love to do a novel, as you're doing with Sissy, I'd love to do one on Ludwig. I think he'd be a fascinating subject.
Well, he is, and of course, when you go to the castles and when you see 70 rooms and everything is... The imagination that he had, the ideas he had, it's thrilling. And every once in a while I will think about, you know, modern millionaires, billionaires, and the kind of places that they're building. And they don't have this imagination. They're not building something that's going to be, you know, they build things just not as a glory to beauty, just, you know, just to build something big. But when he went big, he went big.
He did. He had a great imagination. He was really something. Neuschwanstein inside is just magical. It's like a Wagner opera with all the paintings and everything that are in there. It's like something from Disneyland in some respects, but it was real. And this guy had this fantastic imagination. And those three sites remain the three largest tourist attractions in all of Germany, generating hundreds of billions of euros, you know, for the country. So he had a lasting impact.
It's true. And his eye for beauty, you know, of course, he adored Sissy because at the time she was considered the most beautiful woman in Europe. And I think he just loved looking at beautiful things.
They had an interesting relationship. It came close to getting married, but Ludwig was not, that was not his thing, and so he wisely walked away from that. He's in many ways a tragic figure, and that's what would make it interesting to do a novel with him, to explore all that happened to him. I mean, his life just spiraled down, and then he was deposed from his throne, and then died 3 days later under mysterious circumstances that we still to this day have no idea how he died.
And I think Sissy always believed that he was murdered, of course. And again, you know, labeling him mad is so weak, it's so lazy, because there's so much more to him.
Yeah, he wasn't, as I said, I don't like to use that term mad with him. I think he was troubled. But that didn't mean that he did not have an extremely sharp intellect and extremely sharp mind. I mean, he actually even conceived of a flying air machine similar to a Zeppelin that long before dirigibles were even created or used. He came up with an idea for one. He had a lot of thoughts in that brain of his. He just, unfortunately, you know, had these problems. His brother was certifiably insane and was institutionalized. His mother had trouble as well. And so it ran in the family very strongly, and it got to Ludwig. He ascended to the throne at 18, so he had no choice. He had to go in very young. But he died when he was 42.
Well, the Wittelsbach had, they definitely had some problems in that family. But the idea of finding a perfect kingdom for him to rule, that certainly gave you fodder for
it did. And then when we located where that kingdom was, it made it very relevant today. That's the thing about my books. I have to have something from the past, something real, something that is pretty cool and you want to know more about. But that something also still has to be relevant today, and I was able to find a connection between that. I don't want to say that because it'll give away what's in the book, but there's something, a very interesting connection between Hawaii and another place in the world that will shock the readers. I know it shocked me, but it's true.
Yeah, it is. It is fascinating. The story that you weave is so incredible, but that's what happens with all of your stories. They are, on the one hand, they're incredible, and then on the other hand, they are credible because you base them on facts. It's like, you know, when you wrote Patriot Threat. Now, what I love when a book sends me to another place, because when you read one of your books, it opens up this whole era, whatever you're writing about, that you want to learn more. And I remember when I read Patriot Threat, which is, of course, the one about the 16th Amendment. I think it's still rather relevant today. People are thinking a lot about income tax at the moment.
Yeah, extremely relevant today. And after writing that book, I'm firmly convinced that the 16th Amendment was never legally ratified by this country. I don't think there's any question it was never legally ratified. It's fascinating. And that thriller deals with that, the question of whether the 16th Amendment was legally put into place or not. And it's an argument the federal courts don't want to hear anything about, but I think there's some serious questions as to whether that amendment was properly done. And that it formed a great novel, and The Patriot Threat was, you know, was the novel that dealt with that.
Yeah, well, I thought it was a fantastic novel, and I remember when I finished it, I said, okay, I have to find out if this is true, and I too agree that I don't think it was ever ratified, and maybe somebody will come along and say, let's get rid of this income tax, because...
Well, they tried to bring those arguments up in federal court, but the federal courts will not even entertain those arguments for obvious reasons. If you were to rule it, you know, you could see the problem that would come. But there were some serious questions that happened back at the time in 1913 when that amendment was rammed through. It was basically the fastest ratified amendment in history, and there's some questions about it. It made for a great novel, and that's what I like. I like to find that thing from the past, something interesting, something fascinating that's real, and then weave a modern-day thriller around it, and that's sort of my thing.
Well, I think every April 15th, you should have a re-release of that book, and people will just, they'll buy it because they're like, they're going crazy with income tax, and I think just reminding them of that book, it will be terrific, because it is true that what you write there is factual, and of course you weave the mystery, you weave the story around it, and Cotton and... and all the people get involved.
Yeah, I try to keep the books about 90% to reality. I keep them as close as I can. I have to trip it up because I'm writing a novel to entertain you, so that 10%. But then I have a writer's note in the back that's going to tell you where I trip that up so that there's no misunderstanding. And like you said, there's been 17 Cotton Malones, but those should not put the reader off. I do not write them where you have to read them in any particular order. You can skip around. You can pretty much read them however you want to, and you won't have trouble.
You skip around in history so beautifully.
Yes.
You go from one period to another. You're always coming out with some brilliant new idea based on a historical fact, and that's what makes it so wonderful. Your books are also so layered because of the fact that you have this backstory for Cotton. So for my listeners who don't know, just talk a little bit about Cotton, because I remember one of the books, which one is it? It's an earlier book, the one where about his father and the submarine.
The Charlemagne Pursuit.
I love that. I loved knowing this backstory. I thought it was so fascinating. So tell my listeners here about Cotton and your concept. Of course, he's so much based on you.
Personality. Yeah. Well, I created him in 2006 in The Templar Legacy, and when you create a new character, you want him to be kind of fresh. He's got to be fresh and a little bit different. So I made Cotton a retired Justice Department agent who lives in Copenhagen now, owns an old bookshop, and kind of gets himself into trouble by getting back into his old profession from time to time. And Cotton started with The Templar Legacy in 2006, and now he's here in The Last Kingdom, 17 books later. And he's a he's not a Daniel Craig kind of guy. He's not a James Bond, shoot 'em up, big physical guy. He's more like, I've always thought of him like a George Clooney kind of guy. He's like a guy next door, a guy that, you know, you would never think would be capable of these things. But he can rise to the occasion when he's called upon, and he can do extraordinary things when necessary. And he lives a quiet life now, but he gets drugged back in periodically and in these adventures, and he's caught on and done very well. I've been very surprised with it, and he gets to keep going on. Interesting thing, though, we have another character in the Cotton Mill series. His name is Luke Daniels. He's a younger character. Came in a few books ago. It's a younger version, almost, of Cotton, where he can make mistakes and mess up and screw up as he's learning what to do. He's going to get his own series starting June 27th. We're going to do three books with Cotton, with Luke Daniels. The first one is called The Ninth Man. It comes out June 27th, and it deals with something extraordinary from the Kennedy assassination, something I don't think many readers will know much about. I know I didn't when I discovered it. So that will be the first adventure, and then there'll be two more coming in the years ahead. And I'm writing those with the great thriller writer Grant Blackwood.
Ah, well, it's wonderful that Cotton has been mentoring him and bringing him along on the adventures, and of course in this one, in the new one. And I love that relationship. And of course, we have Cotton's wife, and tell us about her. And, you know, I have to say about him being an antiquarian and having a bookstore. Of course, that for me, that is like the perfect occupation. And I think it's so wonderful. You, of course, were a lawyer and a politician. It's hard to think of you as a politician for many years. But did you also dream about being an antiquarian bookstore owner?
Oh, I'd love to have owned a bookstore. It'd been a lot of fun. They unfortunately, in today's world, don't make a lot of money, and it's very difficult to have one nowadays. Those kinds of things are kind of gone. But Cotton has a rare bookstore. He deals in used books and rare books, so he's more of a collector's kind of guy, which would actually be kind of fascinating to do. So, and when I was creating him, I needed something different, something fresh, something that no one had done before, and that's why I came up with that idea of making him a bookseller. And we've used that, you know, several times over and over as part of the hooks of bringing in of how the stories start off and how the stories go. So it gives him a little freshness, a little bit different.
It gives him depth, and it's so much fun for me because I literally live in an antiquarian bookstore. I collect books. I have perhaps 500 books from the 1700s and 1800s. That's what I do. One of the things I do. At one point, I had 6,342 books.
Wow.
I've wheedled it down to 3,000. I live that life.
And you do live
that
life.
But I'm not selling anything. I wouldn't sell anything. You become obsessed with them.
Yeah, that's Cotton's world. That's what he deals with. That's what he deals with every day. Yeah, those rare books. And so one day I'm going to do a story that actually pivots around one of those books. I haven't really done that yet. All the stories really just involve him moving off the bookstore and going off and doing other things. But I want to do one that pivots right off an old book. So that may be something one day.
Oh, well, a book where somebody's written inside. I love when I find a very old book, and I found some really old one where some reader has written inside, and then I always try to find out who the reader was. And in fact, I traced one reader, the family of a woman who bought a book, and this is all the way back in 1870. She wrote within the margin, lots of marginalia. Her name was in the book. I traced her family, and it's so exciting. So, yeah, there's a lot there that Cotton can find.
There is. There definitely is.
One of the things I love about you, and of course your wife, that you have been very active in promoting writing and reading for veterans. And I think this is so important. This is one of the things that I love to do. Quite a few of my listeners are vets, and I always tell them, you know, so many of them, particularly the ones suffering from PTSD, I tell them, write a book, not about your problems, but write any book. Write a children's book. Write a cookbook. Write you know, just something that will take your mind off of those things that are hurting you. And I know that you have spent time and visited on USO tours to meet with active military and veterans.
I did. I did a USO tour where we sent five writers over to Iraq. This was back when the war was going on. And we were the first group of writers ever sent into a war zone like that. And it was quite extraordinary. We got to meet with a lot of soldiers. And we found out reading is their number one recreational activity. And they have a lot of small libraries on all the bases. And we went around to five or six places in Kuwait and Iraq back then, and subsequently that they did it three or four more times, more writers, but we were the first experimental group to do it, and it was quite gratifying. I enjoyed it. It was a great honor.
Well, I know that they appreciate it, and it's something so important that I like to participate in Operation Paperback Books, which is an organization that sends books to veterans and to active military. I just want to get back to your wife for a minute. Now, your wife's name is Elizabeth, as a matter of fact, right?
That is correct.
But in the book, tell me about Cotton's wife.
Well, it's not really his wife yet.
Well, yeah, they're, I know.
Not wife yet, but close.
I think of her. He better not dump her.
Cassiopeia Vitt is his love interest, and they have a very close relationship. And that character is based a lot on Elizabeth. And you met her in the Templar Legacy, and then she's come along in the subsequent books. In the beginning, they didn't like each other very much, and now, of course, they're in love with each other, and they had a rocky relationship for a while, and I actually broke them up in one book, and I was going to keep them broke up and move on to something else, but Elizabeth said, no, that's not going to happen. So I brought them back together, and now they're kind of a team now. Mm-hmm. So their relationship has settled down, and they work together, and they've acknowledged their strengths and their weaknesses among themselves, and they're doing much better. And I've enjoyed now playing off each other. They've been together working as a solid team now for about three books, and she's in this book, she takes this book off, so she's not here, but she'll be back next year.
Yeah, well, you know, I think of them as married. I just.
Well, they do too. They think of themselves as married as well, but they're just both a little nervous about that. They don't want to go there. He didn't have a good experience the first time, and she's never been married before, so there are their relationship. I will probably keep it that way. Them getting married probably doesn't work per se. It works better the way it is now.
Well, it works very well because it's a wonderful, wonderful relationship. Your books are wonderful. I'm so thrilled with the new one. As I said, particularly, I love them all, but really this one, because of the connection with Bavaria and my many trips to Bavaria over the years, and to Vienna, of course. And the only trip I still want to do in Europe. I lived in Europe for a long time. I traveled a lot. The only thing I never did was that Danube trip, and I want to take that the cruise on the Danube.
I've done that. You will enjoy it.
Yeah. Oh, I know. And I just never had that time to do that, because of course I've been to Budapest for Sissy, to do the research. So I've done it on land, but I really want to go and do that trip. Well, it's so exciting to talk to you, and to really, your books are so relevant even today in so many ways. Just one book after another, there's always something in the books that just open people's eyes, and I think people do follow along. You know, once they read your book, they do check the history, check, you know, the locations, because you paint these wonderful pictures. You really take us to the locations, whether it's the Swiss Alps or now to Bavaria or all the other places. They're just so very, they're fine writing. And on top of it, I get to hear you talk because I love your accent. I think the last time I talked to you, I think it was Kaiser's Web, and I was just thrilled. You just have that lovely drawl that is it's so
thank
nice.
That that Georgia accent. That's where I was born and raised.
I know. Well, it's there, and it's lovely. I'm glad you kept it. Now, I know that you live on the, I'm in Clearwater, Florida, and you're on the other side, I think. If you ever get to the Clearwater area, you just have to tell me, and you can come in the studio. We'll spend an entire hour, because I would like you to give some advice, your brilliant advice, to my listeners who are starting to write, because you are very succinct about it. You say, read and write.
Yep, that's right. You got to write these.
And you know what rejection is. You've been rejected. And so many times people will say to me, oh, well, you know, he's famous. He's selling millions of books. He's never been rejected. He doesn't know how hard it is. And I say, oh, yeah, I think he knows how hard it is.
I got that down. Yeah, we'll do that one day. I'll be glad to do it one day if I ever get down that way.
Okay, that would be wonderful. It would be a thrill. Again, everybody, you have to get this book. It is wonderful, it's relevant, it's important, and it's a fun read, and you will enjoy it. And again, Steve Barry, thank you for being on Joy on Paper today. The name of the book is The Last Kingdom. People can go to your website and find out more about you. These are standalone books. All of the books you can read in any order, and they're on different subjects, different cases in history, and they're brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you again so much for being on Joy on Paper. Bye-bye.
All right.
Now.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, wow. What a guy. Oh, this is an amazing book. I love this book. Okay, I'm going to go. I think, is my caller online, Big Ed? Okay. Okay. We'll go straight to her. Okay. Claudia Hegadis Long, are you on the phone?
I certainly am. How are you, Patsy?
Fine. Thank you so much, Claudia. And the name of your book is Our Lying Kin. I almost said king. Our Lying Kin. Oh, we do have
there's a little play on words there, yeah.
Yeah. Our Lying Kin. As you probably heard, I was talking to Steve Barry, and he's so amazing. His books are so amazing, and it was lots of fun. But I wanted to talk to you today because when I got your book, when I first got your book, I thought, oh, this is, well, one, there's so many things I like about the book, and you have to tell us, you know, about the storyline. But I love the layout. I love the story about the two sisters. On the one hand, it's sort of a serious book, and then on the other hand, you write sort of very light and funny stuff. So tell us about this book.
Well, thanks, Patsy. Yeah, I listened to your interview with Steve Barry, and it sounds amazing. And it's a little bit of a hard act to follow, but let's give it a try here. Okay, so Our Lion Kin is the second of the Zara and Lily series that I've started. And yes, they can be read in, you know, any order that you wish, of course. But Zara and Lily are sisters. I'm not going to mince words. They're 60 and 59. And they are daughters of a Holocaust survivor and on their mother, and their father is the second generation survivor, in the sense that his parents fled Hungary in 1910, and that era when, you know, all the pogroms were going on. So there is a very serious background, as you say, to the story. And the first was 9/10 of the Law, which dealt with the mother's story, and our line Ken talks a little bit more about the dad's story. But it's not about that in that sense, because Zara and Lily are busy sleuthing around and getting themselves in trouble and, you know, dealing with the pandemic, frankly. So, you know, they're tight sisters. They're really close. But the pandemic has frayed their relationship. And so has what happened to Lily in Nine-Tenths of the Law. So they've become more of themselves. Zara has become so... rule following has become rigid, and Lily's been, you know, conducting a little bit of insurance fraud on the side. So, you know, they're basically getting more and more different. And right, and so as they start to look into things, you know, the insurance fraud and the various other things that Lily's been up to, they start to kind of uncover and unwind their father's double life. And discover the legacy that he had of, you know, he's also post-traumatic and in an era where, you know, John Wayne movies dictated the way men could handle their emotions. So he basically, that's a hard one to say, he basically, you know, chooses anger as his way of lashing out and is living a double life.
And what's so great about, first of all, I must say, I have rejected a lot of pandemic books. I just, my nerves can't take them. And I hate when, like, all the characters are wearing masks. I got one mystery story where everybody's wearing a mask all the time. And I thought, I don't know what these people look like. I can't deal with it anymore. But the pandemic is woven into the story here very nicely. I enjoyed the comments. I enjoyed it was good. You did
it. Well, thank you.
Because,
well, think about it this way. You know, if you write a story about now and you don't mention the pandemic, it would be kind of like writing a mystery or a romance of that taking place in, oh, I don't know, 1943 and not mentioning the war. I mean, it's what's going on. And so I had a choice. I could ignore it and just write my book, or I could put it in as it went along. And the problem with writing contemporary as opposed to historical is that with historical, you know how their wars and their pandemics and their elections all worked out, but what if I wrote it and then it ended up really different? I don't know. You know, it was kind of a hard choice there.
Well, I thought the way you did it was just perfect. Just it's not so heavy that I got depressed. Sometimes it's the books get really depressing. And they're so, it's, of course, the two sisters. There's enough banter between them and funny stuff between them that it keeps the book moving very nicely.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. You know, they are, they're a couple of characters. I mean, in the beginning, they're really at each other's throats. And I think that was why it was important to include the pandemic, because that's really, the isolation made them so angry, I don't know, that they had to like battle at each other. And then as they get back together and they're close again, it's a healing.
And you weave in the story sort of as like not headlines but sections where you have from the family scrapbook, you have little vignettes from the family scrapbook that then relate to the story. So that was, I like the way that you did that.
Well, thank you. I was trying to imagine, because Lily is going through their mother's papers and photographs and everything, and I tried to imagine putting together a scrapbook of their history. And so little bits and pieces, memories, everything people put in a scrapbook. They put in pictures and, you know, mementos, various things. And a lot of this just isn't pretty.
Yeah, true enough. But it really, I think it carries the story along. I love these little breaks where you read the scrapbooks, and then actually I found myself going back and reading some of the scrapbooks individually. You know, once I finished the entire book, I went back and just looked at the scrapbooks again. And I enjoyed that process.
I'm so glad. It's kind of revisiting an old family album, I guess, in some ways.
So, you know, of course, what is your background in writing originally? When did you get your first book published?
Well, you know that I'm a lawyer, right?
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, Steve Barry was also a lawyer for 30 years. So you lawyers
yes,
are...
I was listening to the interview, and I wanted to talk about the 16th Amendment, and I thought, wait a minute, no. That's his story, not mine. But, you know, lawyers, we tend to get excited about that sort of thing. But anyway, I've been writing for a long time, about 20 years, and I self-published a mystery, which was not terrible. And then I wrote, and you can't tell anybody this, okay, but I wrote women's erotic fiction under a pen name.
Okay.
And, yes, and I'm not going to tell you my pen name. And so that was, it pays well. But anyway, that kind of got me good at describing things, let's just say that. Always remember to count your limbs. But anyway, so then I, yeah, think about that for a second. And then I decided I wanted to write something relatively serious, so I wrote Josefina's Sin, which is in 1590 in colonial Mexico. And a lot of people don't know about colonial Mexico with, you know, the Spanish viceroyalty there and the Inquisition reaching all the way to Mexico. And I wrote that and got an agent, and Simon & Schuster published it, and I almost fell over in shock, you know. And so that was 2011 that it came out. And that was followed by two more historical fiction and colonial Mexico books, and one is The Duel for Consuelo, and the one after that is Chains of Silver. And then I wrote one about women in the labor movement in San Francisco, but you can't sell a book like that. So I ended up making it from, you know, the point of view of a prostitute, and that sold the book. And then I stopped and thought, what do I want to write next? And I thought, well, my mom had passed away, and a year after she died, my dad sat down with me and told me her actual story from World War II, which was horrific. She had kept it very, very quiet. It came out in little pieces that we didn't understand. And I thought, and he said, write her story. And I thought, I don't want to write her story. That's her story. So I wrote about two sisters who are, you know, dealing with their mother's trauma in the second generation. And I also made it so that they solve the mystery. And these ladies were, you know, at that point, 59 and 60, or 58 and 59. Because do the math, they have to be. And that was Zara and Lily and Nine-Tenths of the Law.
Well,
and then I said, there's more to this story. There's more to these sisters. So our Lion King.
Well, I think it's fantastic. It's lots of fun. I love at the beginning. And I like things that are just a little bit different from what other people have, something a little bit original. And I liked at the beginning how you wrote, you know, about the caste of thousands or 10 wandering Jews. It reminded me that, you know, when you have 10 Jews and they all have 10 opinions, you do
11.
Have 11. That's true, 11. 11 opinions, always.
Yes,
it's true.
I always say two Jews, three opinions.
Yeah, that's it. We do. And it's true. And I love that. I love that right at the beginning. And I thought it was just a, well, you're clever. You're a clever writer in so many ways, with the layout, the design, you know, the having the scrapbook and this opening, I thought was just wonderful. It's just fun. It makes it interesting. And of course, a story. And we're can we mention the object? Do you want to mention the object? That...
Yes, of course, of course. You, I believe that you're referring to the stolen menorah.
Yeah, yeah. We can we can mention that. There is a stolen menorah, and that is the very important that part of the storyline about a menorah. And I think that, again, very clever, very smart, and it keeps people turning the pages.
I'm glad. Well, you know, the actual story of the menorah is that the true story is that when I was 21, my mom and I went to the Jewish Museum in New York City, and she did exactly what Aurora does in Nine Tenths of the Law. She walked up to this showcase of menorahs, and she pointed to it, and she said, "We had one just like that." And I was 21, and, you know, I was a little bit of a jerk. And I said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, that's really?" And she said, "Again, we had one just like that." And I didn't realize what she was trying to say to me was, this was mine. And, you know, she did go through the Holocaust. Everything she had, everything she knew was taken and destroyed. And it was remembering that after my dad told me her whole story, I thought, you know, I wonder if that was hers, and what would I do now to get it back? And that was the spring for Nine Tenths of the Law. And then, of course, in Our Lion King, that menorah goes on a little bit of an adventure again. And again, like you say, I tried to, you know, as we do, to survive tragedy, we make jokes. And I've always done that. The more upset I am, the funnier I am. And so the book is funny.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's so
and you know, it's what we do to it's what we do as a people. It's what we do as individuals to survive.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I was president of Hadassah here in St. Petersburg, and this book I would pick up so fast for our, you know, our reading group, our book club.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, yeah, I'm in Hadassah up here, and it's hard to get anything right during, you know, we're just coming out of the pandemic in truth, and so we're still kind of remote and various things. So I would love it if they did.
Not just every Hadassah, every library group, they should just pick this book, because you want a book that, you know, particularly when it's a book that covers something in the Holocaust, but you can't do something overwhelming that is so depressing that at the end nobody wants to eat the snacks, you know? I've been to a few like that where it's all so much, so overwhelming that your heart is broken. But in this one, your heart is broken, but you're also laughing a lot.
Heart's broken, but you'll survive.
And you'll eat.
But yes.
Yeah. So especially around the time when we have Hamantash, and boy, we could dig through the Hamantash with this book.
Oh, man, yeah. Well, that's coming up. That's, you know, what is it, a week?
I have it on my mind. Once you bake Hamantash, and your mind is on Hamantash,
start thinking about it, you can't stop.
Exactly. I should have a Hamantash party and have everybody read this book, because it just you feel like you feel that it's just right.
Well, thank you. I'm very proud to hear you say that. I'm in awfully good company there, looking at the list of people that you've been interviewing, because, of course, I went to the website and, you know, being a lawyer, of course, I prepared, right? And can't help that. And I thought, wow, I don't know. These are awfully famous people here.
you saw that I talked to the ambassador from Israel. Wasn't that fun?
Amazing. And, you know, then I also saw you talked to Philippa Gregory. And oh, my gosh. I'm like, oh, no, I don't know what I'm going to say with all these people, but I always find something to say.
Well, you do.
You can't stop me. You know?
and you have something to say with this book, because Our Lion King is lots of fun to read. It's a great book. The mystery is wonderful. Your characters are wonderful. And you're a joy to talk to. So do you have a website you want people to go to?
Absolutely. Go over to www.claudiahlong.com. I don't have the Haggadis in there because that would make that website unfindable, but it's claudiahlong.com, pretty simple. And I'm on Facebook. Do find me on my author page because I'm very active over there. And on Instagram at Claudia Long Novels. And I am anywhere you want to find me, you will find me. And my publisher is Cosma Press, and they have a website as well. And so please do come along and find the book, Our Lying Kin. And it's the one before it is 9/10 of the Law, and there will be another.
Okay, well, and then you will be back.
I don't know if I'll get to see Barry 17.
And you will be back here, Claudia, I look forward to having you back here. As soon as the new release is out, you let me know, and you'll be here, okay?
Thank you. I'm greatly honored, and it was a pleasure to talk to you.
It was a joy to talk to you. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Take care.
Okay, let's do the commercials. Let's do the commercial, and then I'll come back and say bye-bye.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, Hi, this is Patsy, and I am going to say goodbye right now. Thank Big Ed in the control room. And I'm going to, before I leave today, I want to play a book buzz, one of Rita Moreau's book buzzes. And that's what we do here. We play book buzzes to remind you of books that you should not miss. And next week, Rita is going to tape some more book buzzes because she loves to do it. She loves to help authors promote their books like we do here with Devon Miller and Bria Burton. So we're going to play that book buzz from Rita. Meanwhile, I want to just say to everybody, thank you so much for all of the emails I'm getting about the 8th anniversary of Joy on Paper. And I will be bringing back some of the authors over the years that have been on the program and authors that I want to remind you about. And so that's what we love to do here. And I hope that if you have a book, you have to let me know. And if you haven't started the book, start writing it. And meanwhile, we'll play the book buzz from Rita Moreau. And she is the author. Oh, she is so wonderful. She is writing a new series called Wacky. Wacky Florida, and it's going to be lots of fun because she is a hoot and a holler, and I am so excited for her new series that is going to be coming up by the end of the year. And definitely, I wanted to just play a book buzz, and then at the end, Ed will play my bye-bye music, but here goes a book buzz that she recorded, because we want you to remember all the books that we talk about here on Joy on Paper.
Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest book buzz mystery, Bells, Spells, and Murders, a Witch City mystery by author Carol J. Perry. And here's the buzz. Lee Barrett has landed her dream job at Salem's Witch TV. As the new field reporter, she'll be covering events live as they're unfolding. Next on her holiday checklist is an interview with the beloved chairman of a popular walking tour through Salem's historic districts. But it may be his ghost walking this snowy Noel season after Lee finds him murdered in his stately offices, bloody Santa hat askew. With her police detective boyfriend working the case and a witch's brew of suspects, including some bell-ringing Santas, Lee chases down leads aided by her wise cat, Orion, who I love, and some unsettling psychic visions of her own. When a revealing clue leads to another dead body, not even a monster blizzard can stop Lee from inching closer to the truth, and a scoop that could spell her own demise this killer Christmas. But don't take it from me. From RT Book Reviews, an entertaining story that keeps readers guessing until the very twisted and eerie end. Carol J. Perry has done it again in Bells, Spells, and Murders, just in time for the holidays. This is Rita Moreau, also known as Radio Rita, reporting for Joy on Paper.
WTAN, Clearwater FM.